Hi guys, and welcome back to another episode of Whisperia Lane. We're the worst sisters. I'm Sadie.
I'm Suna.
And I'm Ajzom.
Here in the Shire, we have our motto, and our motto is, if attempted murder is a crime, then attempted comedy is a podcast. This week, we're going to be covering episode 19 of Desperate Housewives, which is called Live Alone and Like It. In this episode, we see Lynette becoming friends with McCluskey, sort of. We see Susan's mum being Susan's mum and trying to sort of get herself involved in Susan's love life. We see Bree trying to come to terms with her son coming out as gay. We see Gabby and Carlos still arguing about the post-nup and what's to come of their future.
I'm so excited. I really like this episode.
Before we start, can I hijack for a moment with a pop quiz?
Yeah.
Do you guys know what state Whisperia Lane is set in?
Ooh.
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin?
What do you think? Is it Washington?
No, it's not.
Where is it?
So it's actually set in a fictional state called Eagle State.
Eagle State?
Yeah.
And, that's stupid.
So I already suspected that Wisteria Lane and Fairview, which is the area that they're in, was fictional. But the state they're in is also fictional, and it's called Eagle State. And I realized that today, because I saw on Lynette's license plate, it said Eagle State. And me, not being American, was like, ooh, which state do they call the Eagle State? And I looked it up, and it's just a Desperate Housewives thing.
How bizarre.
Yeah.
So there's 50 states to choose from. They had to make one up.
That's right. Yeah. I think the show creator, Mark Cherry, he wanted to create a show that was kind of just representative of suburban America, kind of influenced by the 50s.
Yeah, right.
So he just created this fictional state.
He could have picked a better name than Eagle State.
I know, right? How American, though?
I know. I was just thinking, I think Wisteria Lane fits perfectly because it's kind of like, it sounds old-timey, sounds 50s-ish, like Wisteria and everything. But Eagle State's so, like, in-your-face American.
Yeah. So, yeah, we can get into it now. I just wanted to share my little finding with you guys.
That is a good find.
That is a good find.
I've seen this show so many times, I've never noticed that they were in a different state. Like, I don't know where I thought it was set. I guess I thought it was somewhere like...
I was thinking somewhere like Missouri.
Yeah.
Somewhere Midwestern.
I've never been to America, so I just guessed it was Wisconsin because that's my favorite state.
Is it because you're a cheesehead?
Probably. Go Packers.
Cool. We can get into it now.
Yeah, we can start with Lynette.
Okay, so Lynette has an ongoing argument with her crossroad neighbor. They've got like a love-hate war going on.
I don't see much love, to be honest, because,
I think it starts off as a hate war.
Because, like, even a few episodes ago, we see her coming in being like, your kids would have been better off raised by a pack of wolves. Well, she just barges into her house.
Yeah.
But to be fair, her kids were stealing.
Yeah, okay. But also, remember when Lynette is like, Mummy, you made Mummy look bad in front of Mrs. McCluskey, and that's her sworn enemy.
Yeah. And we start this episode with Mrs. McCluskey stealing Lynette's bins because she left them out 2 days past bin day.
I know. So good.
I've never understood that rule. Where I live, all the bins stay out all the time. Like, you don't bring them back in. You just walk out of your house, go to your bin, put it there, and it stays there. What is this thing that people are on in the Western world about bringing your bins back in? Why would you want that bin so close to your house to begin with?
It's so unseemly.
Yeah, so no one knows you have garbage.
Secret. That's one secret I'll never tell.
Exu, garbage girl.
See, this is stupid because then in a later episode, you see Susan in the dead of night trying to shove a plastic bag into her rubbish bin, and she's confronted by Paul. So if her rubbish bins were by her house, why is
maybe
he
that was midnight? Yeah, maybe that was midnight.
Ridiculous.
Defeated by facts and logic.
Oh, it was midnight. Ridiculous. Everyone knows midnight is Thursday.
My bin day is a Wednesday morning, right? They come out on a Wednesday morning. But we never take our, like, no one takes their bins in here. It's just odd to me that that's an added chore that people have to do.
So I live in a set of units at the moment, and my favourite thing about living here is that I don't have to care when bin night is, because I never have to take in and out my bins. We just have one collective bin and it gets emptied when it gets emptied.
See, how much better is that?
I live in units similar to Suna, but we all have our own individual bins, and we missed the recycling last week because we came just as the truck was leaving. We realised we hadn't taken the bins out, and now we have to wait a full another fortnight for the recycling to be taken out. So we have a month's worth of recycling.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. You have to – do you also have to have a timetable as to when you're recycling and your bin is picked up? Like, yeah. Do you have to remember if you're week A or week B or whatever?
Yeah, because recycling only gets picked up every fortnight.
Bro, I think I'd just, like, live in a landfill. I don't think I'd have enough memory or any, like, processing capability in my brain to remember all of that.
Give yourself some credit. It's not that hard.
If it's not that hard, I'd do my if you got a month's load of recycling.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I've only missed it, like, maybe twice since I've been living here.
Which is 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that I got that little bit of information, but no, I think I like our system better, which is just leave your bins outside and walk to your bin.
Okay, ugly street.
Shitteria Lane.
Oh, my God. I'm actually impressed that got a laugh because I was expecting it to be dead silence.
Oh, my God. You literally killed your sister.
That was a good one. I like that one.
Shitteria Lane.
Anyway, back to Lynette and Mrs. McCluskey. So while they're fighting over this whole garbage situation, Mrs. McCluskey basically has a medical emergency and they have to call in the ambulance. And Lynette, for a moment, daydreams about how she'll die and a nice family with twin girls that'll marry her twin boys in 20 years' time. And she's wondering whether she should let her die or not. Luckily, Lynette doesn't let her die, and she rides along in the ambulance with her to take her to the hospital. Mrs. McCluskey is so moved by this that she brings Lynette a Tiffany lamp that has been in her family for a while, right? And she says, thank you so much for that. She kind of starts to think, though, that her and Lynette are now friends. Lynette saved her life. And now she's starting to think that Lynette is friends, wants to be her friend. She's asking her, can you take me here? Can you take me there? I'll run along on errands with you, etc. She brings her a nice basket of avocados.
Oh, my God. This was the best thing ever is when she brings her the avocados because she's like, I have an avocado tree, but yeah. I hate them. But your family seems like the type that likes guacamole.
Also, what a compliment. I wish someone would say that about me and my family.
I know, but my favorite part about this is that, like, later on in the episode, they're having taco night and they have guacamole.
Yes, exactly. She's so perceptive.
She is so perceptive. But the way she said your family seems like the type that likes guacamole seemed like an insult. Like, guacamole is not delicious.
Yeah, I know. Lynette didn't even know what to do with that information. She was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I know.
I guess we like guacamole.
I know. But yeah, so Lynette doesn't have the same feelings or friendship towards Mrs. McCluskey. And she basically dumps her and says, I don't have enough time for you. Get out of here and take your Tiffany lamp with you.
But after that happens, Mrs. McCluskey kind of disappears. Like, Lynette notices she hasn't been out and about. And the most unrealistic thing that's happened in Wisteria Lane so far happens.
Oh, my God, I know.
A delivery guy tries real hard to deliver mail. Like, this is unrealistic. Don't get our hopes up like this, guys.
Literally, because we were just talking about this the other day, how we are convinced delivery drivers just whisper near our door from their trucks and then drive away.
Like, how did you miss me when I was sitting at home waiting for my delivery when my dog's literally hear leaves blowing out the front? How did they not hear you and your truck? What kind of ninja skills did you use to deliver the sorry we missed you note?
Literally. And, like, I work from home. I work from my couch next to the front door. I would not have missed that knock, you know?
Yeah, exactly. This was me as well. I was working from home and I was right next to the freaking door. Like, why you not deliver the mail? And then they make me chase it up for 600 years.
Yeah. They're like, you haven't picked up your mail. Where are you?
I know. I'm at home where you fucking left me.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, this delivery driver is like, yo, your neighbor really needs her mail. So can you just sign for it real quick?
Yeah.
And Lynette does and everything. And then she ding dong ditches. She leaves the package at the door, dings and runs away. But the weirdest thing happens. Lynette later on that night still sees that package there. And she's like really torn about whether something's happened to Mrs. McCluskey or she's just away, because in her own words, she never goes anywhere. And she decides, okay, enough's enough. I'm going to go over. I'm going to make sure she's all right. So she gets a spare key from one of the other neighbors and just lets herself in and brings the package in. And turns out poor Mrs. McCluskey couldn't get the front door because her arthritis is playing up and she wasn't able to open her pills, her pill bottles for her arthritis.
Which is sad.
It is sad. It is really sad. And, like, also really dumb of the pharmacy. So the pharmacy put her arthritis medication in a childproof bottle. Like,
yeah, you can have more experience than that.
Yeah, I know. I know. But this is where Lynette starts talking about life obligations, because Mrs. McCluskey says, I don't want to, you know, don't feel any obligation. I don't want to be a burden to you, basically. And Lynette starts this whole speech about how life is full of obligations. Like, you think I want to go to, you know, Tom's, you know, Christmas party? No, but you go. You think I want to go get dry cleaners, things picked up from the dry cleaners? No, but you go, kind of a thing. And right now, you're my obligation. We don't have to like each other, but we're two people living on this earth and we're going to help each other.
And I think it's beautiful. Yeah.
I do think it's beautiful. It was a really nice scene.
What warms my heart even more is that as she's leaving, she takes a Tiffany lamp with her.
I know.
Yeah, I loved it. Nice blossoming of a relationship.
I think so too. And it kind of like reminds me that Lynette is not a shit person all of the time. Like, because you know how we always complain about how she makes everyone else, like her problem, everyone else's problems and things like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's stuff like this that reminds me that she is a good person, but she's just like a little self-involved.
Yeah, she's a bit self-involved and probably a lot overwhelmed, to be honest, too.
Yes, that's what I was
going to say. She does a lot just by herself. So
she does.
Yeah, I think she needs to, like, take a second and put herself in other people's shoes sometimes, like she did in this episode.
No, I think Lynette is overwhelmed because she does have four kids. One is a newborn with no help from Tom because he's always traveling and stuff like that, and, you know. Also, even if he was traveling and, like, a good husband that supported her and helped her out when he was there, that would be nice, but he's not even that.
Yeah.
Doesn't have any time for herself or anything ever. I think, like, she's doing the best with the situation that she's been given.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
But yeah, I liked to see Lynette think of other people in this episode and like get back to the Lynette I know and love.
There's a Lynette that you know and love?
Yeah.
You don't like Lynette? Lynette's the best one.
She is. She's a tough broad who knows what she wants and she's no nonsense. I love her.
She's top two, Lynette and Bree.
Yeah. Bree is my favorite. Lynette. Yeah, Bree is my favorite, very closely followed by Lynette.
Yeah.
And then Gabby, and then Susan.
Yeah.
It's actually Gabby, Mary Alice, and then Susan.
I was going to say, it's actually Gabby, Mary Alice, the delivery guy, and then Susan.
Yeah. And then after that, Susan's mom.
Yeah. All right. Should we talk about Susan since we're on the topic?
Yeah, let's do it.
Susan's having a hard time with her mom, isn't she?
Yeah, Sophie's a bitch.
She really is.
Is that her name, Sophie?
Yeah, Sophie.
So she's basically like, just to summarize what Sophie's doing, she's basically just like making everything about her all the time, and she's not completely disregarding anything that Susan wants. She's moved herself into Susan's house because she broke up with Morty. And then she's like just trying to go out with men at all weird hours, which is fine, but then she brings them back home. And
with Susan her teenage daughter.
Yeah, Susan raised a very good point and is like, I have a teenage daughter that lives here. Like, you can't just bring strange men back in the middle of the night.
And her mum is so, like, bitchy about it. She's like, what do you mean, Susie? It's only 12:45.
Yeah, like, I really hated in this episode how, and it's more towards, like, the end of the storyline, but, like, I really hated how it was made to look like she was so fun and, like, Susan was bringing it down.
Yeah. Like,
no, her mum is being unreasonable.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. Were we supposed to think that the mum's in the right and Susan yeah, being a stick in the mud? Because I didn't get that.
Yeah, okay, well, let's jump forward to the end. What gave me that impression is literally the whole fight that her and her mum had right at the end when she sends those two guys her mum brought over home.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, okay, like basically she's like, sorry, it's not you, it's me. I'm just mad that you're so over Morty and I'm not over Mike yet because he was the one.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no,
this isn't a Susan problem. Even if you're not over Mike, your mum's still in the wrong.
Yeah, she is. Yeah. She's bringing estrangement into your house without your permission. She's just making you uncomfortable. And even if she wasn't doing all of that, she's also just hitting on everyone in your life as well, like the ice cream truck guy and everything, like people you have to see every day and deal with. And
yeah, yeah, and also like making her go on dates she never agreed to go on. She just invites two men to her house and he's like this one's your date.
I know. Lamont is yours.
Yeah, I'm Lamont.
Like, Susan just came home from what seemed like a long day. I'm assuming she worked and then went to, like, do a workout and stuff like that. She's trying to do good things to herself, get out of the house, be healthy, you know, even though she's sad. And she has to come home to two strangers in her house with peppermint schnapps.
Yeah. Like, her mum just has absolutely no respect for any boundaries, but, like, oh, it's okay because she's fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, no, it doesn't work that way. No. And also, you know what else? Like, talking about Susan's mum, you know what else I hated about one line she said?
What?
When she's like, just before she brought over those two men, basically, she's talking to Susan and the thing. She's like, men have been coming on to me left and right. Like,
no.
As if she isn't throwing herself at people.
I know.
Yeah.
Literally. And Susan kind of does laugh it off, though. She's kind of like, yeah, no, you're not bothering me, mum. She doesn't, like, tell her mum, no, you've been throwing yourself at people and no, like, it's embarrassing me. She still tries to make her feel better.
Yeah.
Do you know what I liked? How Susan was threatening her mum. She's like, I will go back in there and tell him how old you really are.
I know.
But also, the thing I didn't get with that is Susan's mum was out of that guy's league.
Yes, he was.
Yes.
Literally.
And that was the thing, though. I think this show specifically made Susan's mum, like, she flirted with these guys that were, like, you know, and I don't really like to do the whole rating thing, but they made her date guys that were not the same level as her. Do you know what I mean?
Less attractive than her.
Yeah, less attractive than her. Relatively speaking, less attractive than her. And I think they did that on purpose to make it look different to, like, when Susan throws herself at a construction worker.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's reasonably cute because that guy is good looking. But, like, her mum is gross because this guy is not. Like, I feel like that's what the show very much tried to do.
I think so as well. I fully agree with you.
But also not a bad move with the ice cream guy. Free ice cream.
I know, literally. And he can dance. Score.
The only other thing I had to say for Susan was, when she mentions that Mike was the one, I'm like, literally how? He has no personality and you've known him for 10 minutes.
Yeah, and I hate when Susan does say, like, it makes me so upset that, you know, you can move on from being your heartbroken. I'm just broken. You know, Morty is just one guy in a series of guys for you, but Mike was the one. Like, what are you on about? You're like, I don't know, like 12 years old. Like, get over it. There's going to be other guys in your life.
Yeah. And also, like, her mum was with Morty for 5 years and she was with Mike for, like, on and off 2 minutes.
Yes, literally. Literally.
She burned down a house for Mike, okay?
She literally did. She was only with him for 30-second increments.
Yeah. And then the other thing was Susan's mum going over to Mike and being like, Susan loves you.
Oh, like, I hated that.
Okay, first of all, don't interfere. Second of all, it doesn't matter because she's the one that broke up with him.
And third of all, Mike literally said, I'm really sorry, Sophie, I can't do this right now. Someone close to me, very close to me, has died recently. And she's like, yeah, but if you could just.
I know. I was like, don't interfere. Just leave people be.
I can't wait for this lady to leave.
I know.
Yeah, I know.
She's the bane of my existence.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this episode is just Susan mothering her mother, sadly.
And Julie's missing.
Yeah. Because you couldn't have someone mothering her mother who's mothering her mother. Because then Julie can't be the grandmother in this scenario.
She literally would have to be the grandmother. She'd be knitting at the front while they're coming.
Literally.
All right. I reckon we should move on to Gabby next because hers is pretty short and sweet. Yep. Gabby's storyline starts with Carlos and Gabby fighting about the whole post-nup thing. So as I remember the last episode, he literally held her down and forced her to sign the post-nup after they had a fight about it.
Yes. And I'm so confused because they're being like so cutesy fighting about it now.
Well,
like,
I don't
to the police.
That cutesy fighting left you with a bruise on your arm. No, thank you.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think this was a cutesy fight, but yeah, I get what you mean.
It wasn't as serious as it needed to be. Like, she needed to leave him.
Yeah, agree. But I think, like, this is, like, probably how they're so similar. Like, they're both so competitive. They have to kind of win the relationship.
Yeah.
But they're both, like, trying to win the relationship. I think Gabby's just trying to claim some power back is what she's doing. Because legitimately she could leave him and find someone else. Like she says, pretty girls are never lonely.
Yeah, correct.
So I think they're just both trying to win the relationship.
And I think that's such a good point because we were talking about this before we even started covering the show, you and I, saying that, like, you know, Carlos is probably, like, the worst of the husbands because, you know, he's been tampering with her birth control pills, like, you know, did slave labor, things like that.
Yeah.
And – but he, I don't hate him as much as I hate Tom because I feel like they're so, like, suited to each other. Like, they're so, like – they're both bad people.
Yeah, they're both bad people.
Like, the thing with Carlos and Gabby is that they know that they're selfish and bad people and they
– Yeah.
They're okay with it.
Yeah, they own it.
The thing about this initial scene in this show, though – is when Carlos is trying to, like, smooth it over. I said he apologizes kind of, but I don't think he actually ever said the word sorry. He just says he's not proud of what he did.
And he took it too far.
And he took it too far. But I feel like if that was true and he had any actual regret, he would tear up the post-nup right then and there.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's like, but I'm not ripping up the post-nup. So I guess he isn't at all sorry and would do it again.
Yeah, he got what he wanted, so he's fine with it.
Yeah, exactly. So they're having this kind of standoff thing where he's like, nah, I'm not doing it because you'll leave me when I'm in prison. And she's like, well, you better cancel it or else. So they're kind of at this standoff. And Gabby does the mature adult woman thing and she runs off to her teenage boyfriend and is not only just complaining about everything to him, she takes his student credit card.
Yes.
His student credit card.
That his parents had to co-sign. Yeah. From his little lawn mowing business.
Yes. Oh, my God. Like, does this woman have absolutely no morals? Like, what an absolute lowlife.
I know.
Yeah, and the shoes she bought weren't even nice.
No, they weren't. And, like, okay, the shoes aside, I can see she got the shoes to, like, prove a point to
Carlos
that she can get any man. Okay, fine. But, like, why does she have to take herself out to the fanciest freaking lunch I've ever seen in my life?
I know, literally.
Like, go into McDonald's and shut up.
Yeah. Or, like, just have a sandwich. You know he's not rich. You know he's literally a teenager that mows lawns for a living. This isn't Carlos's credit card.
Yeah, but she was expecting it to be fine because it's a credit card, so she can just ruin his life and credit.
I would have already, like, if I was in her shoes, the new ones that she bought, I would already be suspicious about how much money he had available on that thing anyway. Like, what have you got, $200? Like, what have you
exactly
got? Like, I'm not going to be taking myself out to the fanciest lunch and having, you know, $400 shoes.
That food, I don't know how to say this in English, but bars and dann gets misty.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of a joke to say for those listening. Yeah, it won't go down my throat is what people say. It means, like, I couldn't eat it without guilt, basically.
Yeah.
Inflation.
I couldn't swallow it.
Yeah. Correct. Like, how do you not feel like a horrible human being for that? I would feel bad making him buy me Maccas. He's like an 18-year-old who mows lawns.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
Yeah, she ends up getting some other rich guy to pay for her meal. When the credit card declines, she gets out of that situation. And then she goes home and does the thing to Carlos where she's like, well, by the way, I just found some other guy to buy me these shoes. And I remembered that pretty girls are never alone and I'm a pretty girl. And so if you want me to stay around, you better rip up that post-nup.
Yeah.
And so he does.
Yeah, and so he does. And then he's allowed back in the bed.
But she won the relationship this round.
She sure did. All we have left, I think, is Bree and Mike.
Yeah.
Do we want to do Bree first and end on Mike?
Yeah.
Yes.
Sounds good. So Bree is bringing Andrew back from Camp Hennessy. And I love this little bit because Rex is like, just be cool. Just be cool like me. And yeah. Bree is immediately like, honey, I would love you even if you were a murderer. And I'm like, lucky because he is. Like,
I know. That's what I said. I literally said that when we were watching it as well. But also, I love Bree's excuse for wanting to bring him home. She's like, Rex, I don't know if you know this, but our son just came out as gay and there's like 200 boys here. We need him home.
Don't want to tell you what it is because I'm a lady, but you can imagine.
You can imagine.
Oh my God, but the Breeness just keeps breeing because yeah. Then they get home and first thing, what does she do? She organizes a dinner with her son and her husband and the priest.
Yes. And she's not like, only that, but the little first thing this priest says, he sits down and he's like, so your mum tells me you've started having sexual desires for other boys.
I know, literally.
Like, break the ice a little, dude.
I know. But like, oh my God. So for the first time ever, like ever, Rex is being a good parent and he's making a point of saying like, look, if Andrew's comfortable with who he is, it's our job as parents to support him and help him through this and everything. So I love him the way he is.
Yeah,
Even if he is gay. And then Bree's like, correction, it's not gay, it's sodomy.
Yeah, exactly. Could you at least wait till dessert before you call our son a sodomite?
I know. This whole dinner was wild from beginning to end.
It really was. Yeah. But can I just add to your point about Rex? Yeah, he might have been a good father in that moment, but he was a shit husband.
He was.
I feel like this is a fight they should have had before this dinner party ever happened.
You have this
dinner party in front of your son and a priest, and Rex also does the little, like he says, oh, yeah, our job is to support him, and does a little nod to Andrew to show that he's the cool parent.
Yeah. I'm not a regular dad. I'm a cool dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's in the right, but this is a fight they should have had before he invited the priest over and showed up.
Okay. But he did say that he told Bree, I think this is a terrible idea. Please don't do this.
Yeah. All right, so let's think of it this way. Rex has voiced his concerns and the reasoning why he doesn't want this party to go ahead, and Bree still Bree-dozed the entire thing and went ahead with it anyway. So who's in the fault here? Now, if your partner or spouse specifically, explicitly told you, I am not comfortable with what you are about to do, and you still do it.
I would have not gone to the dinner if that was.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Like, it's not like just a person you don't like that's coming to dinner, which you're like, fine, I'll suck it up and go to the dinner. This is like a moral thing, right? Like, if you're that morally opposed to this, don't go.
Exactly. I fully agree.
But then he's open to leaving his son by himself with a priest and Bree.
But then he could have said to his son, your mum's doing this, don't go to dinner, be gone.
Devil be gone.
Literally, jump out the window, go. But when Rex does the back Andrew up and gives him like the cool dad nod, Bree also blurts out, well, your father's into S&M, it's no wonder you're a pervert.
Oh my God, so good. That poor priest. Poor priest has suffered at the hands of this family so long.
I know. After this awkward dinner, okay, also can I just say, I thought there were going to be more, like, inappropriate gay jokes when she said she was making bratwurst for dinner. Yeah, I thought there was going to be, like, a penis joke in there somewhere.
I didn't.
I did.
Bree's a lady. She would never.
I didn't say it had to be from Bree. I was expecting Andrew or Rex to say something. But after this dinner, Bree is sitting there at her little couch looking through baby photos and summons Andrew over and tells him that when I say I would die for you, it's not an expression because I nearly died during childbirth because I told him to prioritize you. Please go talk to Reverend Sykes because if you don't and don't change your ways, you won't come to heaven and it's going to be really lonely without you.
Yeah.
And I'm just here thinking like, so he's not going to go to heaven because he's gay, but not because he killed someone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That was the first of my points about this scene. The second point is the way Andrew resisted the urge to say, don't worry because we'll be in hell together.
I know, literally.
Because that was like
the obvious comeback to that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Mum, you won't be lonely when we're in hell together. Yeah. Correct.
It's yes. Woulda, coulda, shoulda at that point. But
well, I think he was just too upset to say. I think he was quite taken aback by that comment.
Yeah, I think I would be too.
Like, Bree stepped over the line on that one.
Yeah, but I think, like, Bree genuinely believes it. That's why.
I think
like,
so too, yeah.
I think genuinely she does love Andrew to death, but her religiousness is causing her to be scared for his future.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what it is.
The literal priest wasn't as taken aback by this information as Bree was.
Yeah, but it's not the priest's son. He doesn't care if you go to hell or not.
Yeah, exactly.
I've done my job.
And the priest makes a point of saying we can't force anyone onto the path of righteousness. He has to want to do it himself.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel like it 100% is just Bree's religion. Like, I feel like if she didn't think that Andrew was going to suffer in hell for all of eternity, she wouldn't care.
I fully agree with that as well. But Andrew does go to see Reverend Sykes, as he promises his mum, because he's like, you know, I want to be in heaven with you. But Andrew, being the little asshole that he is, continues to asshole.
Yeah. And this time is warranted assholery.
I don't think it is. Like, okay, like, I get that it's really disappointing and upsetting and horrifying that your mum thinks this about you and that you're going to go to hell and everything. But still, you don't need to, like, go tell this reverend that you're planning on pretending to be a good boy and then ruin her life.
Yeah, I feel like that is a bit of an overreaction. And also, I feel like he could have just been honest to his mum about his feelings to start with and see where that led. Like, he could have turned around and said to Bree, even if not in that moment because he was shocked.
Yeah.
Like, he could have said to his mum, like, I get it. I understand what you mean, but I actually don't believe in God. Like,
yes, exactly.
Something I'm worried about, which is what he said to the priest. Like, he could have had that conversation with his mum and then seen where it went.
Exactly. But I did I found it funny. Andrew's like summary of how he's not really gay. He just wanted to get out of camp, but because he likes vanilla ice cream, but sometimes he wants chocolate.
Yeah. So I think he's telling the priest he's bi.
Yeah, exactly. And the priest is just like, well, God would prefer if you stayed with vanilla.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought it was very funny. The way he phrased all of that was very good.
Yeah.
I just and like then, that he used the ice cream analogy.
Yeah. Different cup.
Yeah.
It's a different cup.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what happens with Bree and Andrew. And then we see Andrew going to church with his mum and making some snide comments about how inspired he was at church to Reverend Sykes, knowing he can't say anything to Bree.
And he literally looks like Andrew is the son of Satan.
He does. Yeah. He really does. Okay, question, guys.
Yeah.
Who is your favorite priest, Pastor Ted or Reverend Sykes?
Pastor Ted.
I would say Reverend Sykes is funnier.
I think Reverend Sykes is funnier too. I don't like Pastor Ted being like, my calling came to me on a boogie board in Samoa.
He's not like other reverends. He's a cool reverend.
I know. Literally, I think Reverend Sykes is cooler.
Is a reverend and a pastor the same thing?
I don't think so. I think they're both of Catholicism, but different, like, flavors of it.
Yeah, different colors.
You what now? Bless you, Arjo.
Cool. And that leaves us with Mike.
Yeah, it leaves us with Mike.
Mike.
So, Mike, he gets some interesting things this episode. It's not long, but it's interesting. So we find out the body in the toy chest belongs to, or was, who? Sadie?
Deirdre.
Deirdre was in the toy chest. So things are starting to tie together.
Mike gets called in by Noah, who is Deirdre's dad, and he gets the information that Deirdre's body's been found in the toy chest, cut up into small pieces, so obviously he's digesting that information. But, now that he knows that Deirdre's dead, he wants to move forward as fast as he can with the funeral, but he also wants to know what happened to his daughter more than anything. So he sends Mike off to find Sullivan, is it? Yeah, Sullivan, who is the cop that was paid off by Noah for Mike a couple of episodes ago. They're in a parking garage because that's the best place to meet inconspicuously.
Of course.
They have words. They have a bit of a fight, and Mike gets and ends up getting punched in the face by Sullivan, who is sort of, like what I said, on a high horse for a dirty cop.
He is. He's like, he's literally being paid off. He's here in a dodgy area meeting somebody to give police files away because he's on the payroll of some rich guy.
Not just and somebody. Somebody that he's complaining about is a felon.
Yeah. And, like, he is acting like he has the moral high ground. Like, mate, do you have mirrors where you go, where you come from?
No.
Or are they all two ways so you don't see?
Where did you come from? Where did you go?
But it sounds like we find out from this scene that the person that Mike killed in the past was a cop.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because he got called a cop killer. No, we didn't. This was a new piece of information because he got called a cop killer.
So this is why I think Sullivan's particularly mad. But, man, what a high horse to go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I was going to say is, so Noah has this cop on his payroll. What does he need Mike for? Why doesn't he just get the cop to look into it?
Because didn't he say, like, a couple episodes ago, no one's ever going to be as invested as Mike is?
Yeah, but, like...
Yeah, but Mike's got no skills. Like, what's Mike's skills? Yeah, going to prison and killing a cop?
That's exactly what I mean. Like, there's this guy here. He works in the police force. He has access to, you know, resources, databases, information, etc. Isn't he a better pick to solve your crime since you're already paying him off?
He's probably doing both. He wanted someone to live on the lane.
I don't know, man. Seems sus.
So he opens up the file, and the first things that one of the first things that he sees is the toy box list of names of people who owned the same toy box, and on the list is Paul Young.
Yeah, he gets
suspicious then.
Cool, and that's the episode.
Okay, so thanks guys for tuning in for this week's episode of Whisperia Lane. Join us next week for another episode of Shadeswood. We'd love to hear your feedback and your thoughts. So you can reach us on our socials, which is at Sister Worst on Twitter and at Worst Sister Shire on almost anything else. So that's Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. You can send us an email on worstsistershire@gmail.com. All right, so I'll count us out. 1, 2, 3. Hadabam.
Hadabam.